And now, your ChillPack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund here in the offices of Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core for your ChillPack Hollywood Hour with your host and raconteur, Mr. Phil Lernis, ladies and gentlemen.
We are not going to discuss Anderson Cooper.
No.
360.
No.
Or any aspect of Anderson Cooper's life on this show.
But what a fantastic cover on Entertainment Weekly last week.
So he was on the cover. Is that where he came out?
No, I think it was just everybody who's come out over the last few years. It was sort of the rundown of all entertainment history. And then he was in the article as well. But I didn't, you know. I'm three issues behind on Entertainment Weekly. Don't tell me what happens with the True Blood episode.
We live in this era, right, where any time you don't like what a news person is saying, you talk about their obvious liberal bias or their obvious right-wing bias or their
lamestream media.
The elite, the liberal New York elite.
Right.
And so it is interesting that a journalist... that's just the issue of it to me that's interesting is the idea of, making public his homosexuality and now thereby knowing that there's going to be people who would say, oh, well, now he's got a... That, we know what that means.
That he suddenly has a mandate.
Suddenly he's all about Obama. And he's all... whatever it means. So it is interesting for a journalist to do that. And maybe we will, actually. I said we weren't going to talk about Anderson Cooper.
No.
Here we are talking
already
about him.
We started with
but
the talking.
But maybe this will become an important issue, this thing about journalists maybe leading with who they are and with their own personal viewpoint. And instead of... nobody buys objectivity anymore. And so maybe the way to reclaim objectivity is by saying, I'm a human being and this is the human being that I am. And this is how I see these things.
Right.
Now that you know it, now maybe
you can listen
to what I have to say.
Grounded.
Go, oh, well, that makes sense.
Grounded in the subjective as opposed to the illusion of the objective.
Oh, I like that.
See,
that's
what
good.
I
and you said you were tired.
I know. That's when I come up with these bon mots. Because I've been flying all night, mister. Don't kid yourself. I was over on the East Coast on a... What was I doing? I was over there
for a high school reunion.
High school reunion.
You were crashing high school reunions.
I certainly was. I was thrilled to be in upstate New York at a high school reunion. Plus, also, setting up for this Halloween's ghost tour in Springville, New York.
Wow.
I am going to be the tour guide through the haunted art galleries, butcher shops... and theaters.
Because you're going looking for the ghost that you saw.
I saw.
After the screening of The Truth Is Out There?
Just before. I was introducing the screening of The Truth Is Out There is when I saw my very first ghost. And now I'm going to go and show other people where I saw that ghost plus other horror.
I feel like I want to be there filming that.
Well, I think maybe you do.
You had a little bit of a rough time on the East Coast, and we said that we wouldn't talk about the specifics, although, quite frankly, you won't be offending anyone because they don't have power, and they're unlikely to ever have power again, so they can't listen to their ChillPack Hollywood Hour.
Somehow, yes, the entire East Coast has melted down their entire electrical grid. I don't know how they did that.
What has seemed to me, and you were there, you could tell me, but what seems to me is to be just really tough. Is the combination of the storms and the electrical outages, which happens about three times a year back there, from what I understand. But you have these storms immediately followed by 100-degree heat.
Yeah. So it was like an inch of rain that blew sideways at 80 miles an hour, knocked down all sorts of trees and power lines. And then immediately the clouds disperse and there's 80% humidity and it's 102 degrees.
Would those qualify as gale force winds? Is that what we mean when we say gale force winds?
I think it switches from gale to hurricane right around 80 to 82 miles an hour.
I always thought that would be a great name for a horse. I'm not kidding.
Gale horse winds?
Gale force.
Oh, gale force.
Just call it gale force. And then when it wins... Gale Force wins.
See?
Wouldn't that be nice? This has been another installment.
Are you not a horse owner? I don't understand.
We'll run that by Lyle and he'll get...
get a horse. Something with a good bloodline.
Of course. So you were arm candy. You were Hollywood actor arm candy.
Yes.
at a high school reunion.
Yeah.
And where was that again?
In Wellsville, New York, home to the Wellsville Lions. I don't know.
Were they the Lions? They were. You are correct, yes, sir. What has correct. He won?
The Frisbee. The Wellsville Lions Frisbee.
And
a restaurant called Texas Hot, which everyone eats at.
And the reunion, the high school reunion.
Oh, yeah, and the high school reunion.
How was that? Have you ever gone to your high school reunion?
Never. Never in a million years. I'd never gone on my... Because everybody's hooked up with me on Facebook, and every time I do stand-up in my hometown, all my high school friends come out. So basically, the equivalent of the high school reunion has been my stand-up, live stand-up appearances, where I've gotten to see everybody and stood up on stage and made fun of them. So it's been, you know... cathartic and lovely all at the same time.
Revenge.
Yes.
Is a dish.
Best served hilariously.
Hilariously in the cold of...
the winter.
Alberta? Is that where it is?
Manitoba.
Manitoba.
Yes. So, but, you know, here's the other thing at this one. There wasn't really much to talk about because they're all connected on Facebook already. So it's like, hey, I just saw... And, you know, half of them live still in that town, so... It was just what we called a high school reunion. They called Thursday night hanging out.
So was that the case with this reunion?
It was the case, yeah. There was lots of Facebook going, oh, yeah, I see you two are running marathons and stuff. How's that going? Good. And I see you are living in Florida. How's that going? Good.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it wasn't like, oh, my God, I haven't seen you in 30 years. What are you doing? Oh, you got to catch me up. It wasn't that. It was like Facebook and everybody is already connected everybody. And we're sort of like, no, I'm good. So there was
a limited,
yeah, I know. It wasn't really a lot to talk about. Odd, isn't it? How social media has destroyed high school reunions.
Wow.
I know.
That's like a horror film. It's a really a really bad horror film.
Yes. But at the same time, Wellsville is a beautiful town. Love it. And I'm taking many photos. I'm going to create some paintings from that town.
You know, though, because of all the changes on Facebook.
Ah, yes.
I find that the connection is starting to get lost. I mean, it becomes harder and harder to actually
connect and follow,
keep up with what's going on. I mean, I don't know what posts I'm seeing and why.
Right.
Exactly. And in fact, we've been sending out emails, messages, among other things, to listeners of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour who are on Facebook, because what we're finding and what other pages have been finding is that when you post something, it only makes it to 10 or 20% of the people who have liked your page because there have been so many changes. So just because you liked a page doesn't mean you're actually getting the posts in your news feed anymore. Oh. The reason being because Facebook is now, it's Facebook plus five is what everybody's calling it. You have to pay money to get your posts delivered to the people who have already liked your page. You have to pay basically as if it was an ad.
What?
There is a way around it, which is if people go to the page they liked and they let their cursor hover over the liked button, a submenu will appear. And as long as show in news feed is checked, then you should be getting the posts. So we've been sending, as you know, you sent out
yes.
many of these this weekend. You know, just suggestions to people that if they want to make sure that they get the posts for both Chill Pack Hollywood Hour and also for The Truth Is Out There, because we've got some announcements coming about that. That'll be really fun to do that. And whatever page you like, if you're on the Facebook, and I guess so I should say we're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
So easy.
And if there's a page you like and you wonder why you haven't been getting posts, maybe go and try that.
Please.
And maybe unlike it, re-like it, whatever the page is.
Please
re-like
it, yes. Whatever you like.
But
double check that.
That's the workaround that
Man.
My friend Tom Keesh called my attention to.
Wow.
Wonderful actor Tom Keesh.
Fantastic.
So, well.
That's been our thing. What was your weekend like?
Oh, I went to Ethan Dettenmeyer's 40th birthday party. This is the host
of Combat Radio?
Producer and host of Combat Radio. Very good friend of ours.
Yes.
A surprise party up in Canyon Country where he lives.
Which he already knew about.
Did he?
Well, because it was on Facebook.
He said that he didn't know, that he hasn't been checking. But he's such a nice guy, he would say he didn't know anyway. But it was a blast.
Was
it? I was out there all night long. It was so much fun and such a great
Big crowd?
Great turnout. And, you know, the thing is that it's always so much fun when you go and do his show.
Yes.
And this is kind of just because of who he is. He's so enthusiastic, and he's so genuine, and he wants the people who come on his show not only to succeed, but to have a good time.
Right.
And so you feel that when you're in there, and you automatically feel a friendship with anyone else who's
already
on that
there.
Show.
You know, he's picked them.
And that extends, now I must say, to anyone who's been on the show, whether or not you were on that show with them. You just feel like you're a part of this community, and there's this automatic friendship there.
We experienced
that with Juliette Landau and her husband, Dev, when we met them.
After the play.
After Danny and the Deep Blue Sea. It was like we were already friends, and we had talked on air, of course.
Right.
But it's, and in fact, I heard from Juliette. She's in Africa doing a movie, and she's doing Raging Bull 2. She's in the cast of that.
Come on.
So she, anyway, but I just thought that was very cool. She's keeping in touch because He makes friends happen.
Now, this big party was...
Doug Jones was there.
That's
of course, we love Doug Jones.
Yes.
Mark Ryan.
Yeah. Voice of Bumblebee. And
Rick Mora, actor and stuntman and model. Rick Mora, big deal. He can't go anywhere now without being recognized by all the Twilight fans.
Oh.
And... spoken word artist Eric Mark was there. I mean, there were so many great, great people.
And why did it go late? Or how was...
We were almost leaving.
Uh-huh.
Our friend Pete Handelman was my arm candy. My wingman for the
your
party.
Your wingman?
Designated driver. which was so great. Which basically meant that we were handing the drinks back and forth.
Right.
Taking turns.
Designating. You cut
you're
the
driving.
Alcohol.
No, you're driving. But I think about midnight, we were almost ready to leave, and there were just a few hearty souls left, because, of course, it had started at like 6 o'clock, 6:30.
Right. Big crowd then.
And it was a dinner party and all of this, but at midnight, there were maybe 8 of us left, let's say.
Let's say that.
And... we were thinking we were getting ready to leave, and then Ethan said, "You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to go sit out around the fire, because you know we'd set up a bonfire way across the property overlooking the canyon."
Wow!
And so then we just sat around there, and it almost became like an episode of Combat Radio.
Yeah.
And as you know, 2 hours kind of breezes by.
Kind of goes by pretty quick,
especially with some of the expensive bottles that were on that particular installment.
Oh, right. Some sponsored alcohol from the radio show again. That's fantastic. Now, a bonfire in this fire season, isn't that a little dangerous in the canyon country?
It was. I don't know if it was technically a bonfire. Oh, I mean, okay. They have a fire pit.
Oh,
they actually have. Yeah.
Thank you
like
for dinner.
Bonfire sounded a little more rustic and adventurous.
Yeah, and or dangerous.
So I don't know. It was a lot of fun. And we're going to be hanging out with Ethan and the Combat Radio crew at PopCon here
this
in LA.
Weekend, this week. It's going to be a big deal. PopCon, and if you don't have your tickets, get to it, because it's at the LA Convention Center. I believe it starts Thursday, if I'm not mistaken. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, starting 10:30 a.m. every day till about 6. There'll be booths of a whole bunch of actors, including myself and Claudia Christian and Mark Ryan and...
Marina Sirtis will be there. I can't wait to see her. I haven't seen her in quite a while.
You know, this is kind
Billy
of...
Billy D. Williams, who I'll be interviewing for your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
I did. I was a drug dealer to Billy D. Williams' movie in Mask of Death. Back in the old 90s.
He was on Combat Radio on Friday, and he just kept refusing to answer any Star Wars questions, until one tweet came in about him being a bad guy in the Star Wars movies, backstabbing Han.
Right.
And then he let loose. I didn't backstab Han. You don't understand, I was a businessman, and I had the cape. It was the coolest thing ever. I had the cape. That makes me a good guy.
Come on. Capes are good guys.
Speaking of good guys, there's something we haven't talked about on the show, and I can't believe you've been... negligent in doing this. Chris Bono, the very talented, very funny, super cool Chris Bono, has been working on the Electric Bono Land
yes.
series of videos YouTube.
This new web series that is
Electric
just...
Electric Bono Land. Yeah. And there are several episodes, and this is really great, weird stuff.
Yeah.
You were in one of them.
I was in one of them.
Why don't we take just a moment and you describe this web series?
Well...
That people can find at youtube.com/user/electricbonoland/videos. You know what? I'll put the link up
put
on
the link up on that one. Chris Bono, for those who don't know, is a good friend of mine, a stand-up comic and visual artist that we often, when we get together, talk about art and comedy.
Great painter. Great
painter.
I love his stuff.
You may know his Coco, his Conan, one that is actually signed by Conan.
Not Conan. Conan O'Brien.
Yes. Not Conan.
Right. The Destroyer.
Yeah. Conan, no. The O'Brien Destroyer.
So tell me about Electric Bono Land.
Well, he started,
and then we'll get our show started.
Yeah, he decided. we haven't started. Yeah. This is just a pre-chat. He decided to start this web series with this guy named Mike, who's the cameraman, editor, stuff like that, and they work together. And it's sort of a exploration through the consciousness of Chris Bono, and every episode is something different. And so he said, "Hey, do you want to come do something?" And he had no idea what, so we basically got to his studio, and he was going to ask 15 questions in 1 minute. That was one thing that he was going to cut. And then we decided, you know, he's a collector of action figures and stuff like that. So we decided to take the action figures and make a theatrical piece of the superhero action figures using the text from other comic books that normally they wouldn't say, which then, of course, went off on tangents, and some of them broke, and then we recut it so you couldn't tell that that was the premise. It just looks like we were throwing around action figures and breaking them. But hilarity ensued, and because of all the weirdness, it has become sort of this delightful foray into his mind that you have to check every week on YouTube.
That's awesome. We'll post that link.
Yes.
Tell me, what should we start with? Let's start with...
Well, what did we miss last week? How about, should we go backwards this time?
No, there's the breaking news of the week. Of the week. How about this? Because it is Independence Day.
Here it is.
Independence Day. And I wanted to
Canada
talk about...
Canada Day yesterday.
I wanted to talk about the idea of independence, about Independence Day, the 4th of July, and celebrating this. Someone celebrating, or ought to be celebrating, or many people are celebrating, the independence of Katie Holmes. Yes. Now, the Free Katie movement...
The Free Katie movement has finally came to fruition.
For those of you who don't know, divorce was filed between Katie Holmes and Tom Cruise. We really thought those kids would
really hold
stick it out.
And
in true Hollywood fashion, I love this. What preceded the announcement of the divorce,
right,
was the announcement that Katie had dumped the publicist that she shared with Tom Cruise, which was Tom's publicist,
right,
that she then came to after the marriage.
Ah, right.
She was leaving that publicist to go back, I think, to her original publicist.
The proper.
And so that was announced the day before, which is
always
a pretty good sign
that the marriage is over.
A Scientology wedding or marriage is over.
Is over. So, yes. Now, was it? I know in the state of California, you basically have two boxes to check in your divorce papers. One is insanity, and the other is irreconcilable differences. Those are just your two. So,
do you honestly think after I made one Scientology crack, you think I'm stupid enough to go anywhere near an answer to this question? No. The whole reason I brought this up to discuss Katie Holmes in the first place was that it is a perfect segue into...
One's independence.
No.
Oh.
Thanks for ruining that segue into...
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
Your live event of the week.
Ah.
I saw...
A wedding.
Couples Counseling Killed Katie. And this is what really launched Mark Roberts' career. Now, we've talked about Mark Roberts because he wrote Where the Great Ones Run.
Yep.
That Lillian Tucker and so many great actors, Jeff Kober, Holly Folger are in right now, ongoing at Rogue Machine Theater. But Mark Roberts wrote this other play, Couples Counseling Killed Katie, right, and he starred in it. And it was the show that Chuck Lorre saw that made Chuck Lorre say, I want you to come and write for my sitcoms. You're hilarious.
Wow.
And then, of course, he became executive producer, co-executive producer on Two and a Half Men.
Two and a Half Men.
And then created Mike and Molly.
Right.
They have brought it back. Couples Counseling Killed Katie. Mark Roberts performing in it.
No way.
It's, I think, six vignettes set in front of a couples counselor who you never see.
Right.
The couples counselor is out
is
in the audience.
Yeah.
And co-starring with him in it is this wonderful actress, Jessica Tuck. People have seen her. Look her up on IMDb. She's just fantastic. Done so much great stuff. But it's a great... It's really fantastic because she especially gets to show such incredible range. And you're so happy just that, you know, an actress, a mature actress, is getting a chance to show such a wide range and just rips it up and chews it up. And
now, the Kate in the title reference refers to Katie Holmes?
One of the characters. No, not Katie Holmes.
I see. I thought that was not even born
when the show first was on.
Oh,
no,
really?
It's about the first character you meet.
I see.
Spoiler alert. The title spoils something that happens. Couples Counseling Killed Katie. It gives you a little chance.
Where's that playing?
It is at the Elephant Theater. I think it just closed.
What?
This weekend.
Thanks.
But he's got to get back after hiatus to his show, to Mike and Molly.
Right.
And it was really funny. The challenge with it, and, you know, if ever anybody was going to launch this show again, I have an answer to this challenge.
Oh, look at
you.
But
the challenge with it is the breaks between each of the vignettes for the actors to get a breather and to change their costume, their hair, their makeup entirely. You know, especially at the beginning, it's really hard to build the momentum where after every scene you have 3.5 minute breaks for a whole song to play in between. And I do have a way. I have a directorial idea that comes from the text itself that could solve it. So if anybody out there ever plans to produce this, talk to me.
You got to keep that secret up.
It was so funny. And Mark Roberts, he really is just a hysterical performer. And it was a lot of fun because I went with Lily and... she had seats reserved for us. She didn't even know they were going to do that. They reserved seats in the back row in the center. I'm sandwiched between Lily Holloman and the star of Mike and Molly.
Oh, what's her name?
No, the guy who plays Mike.
Oh, the guy who plays Mike.
Yeah.
The stand-up comic.
Yeah, the stand-up comic who was so good, and I can't remember his name. I should have looked it up, but
right. Dare I pull up IMDb while we're
but
talking?
But this was an all-star house.
Right.
It was packed. Reno Wilson, Norm from Cheers, George Wendt. So many recognizable. And this is why we brought up doing live events of the week in the first place.
Right.
Was because so many people want to know, how can I learn about acting? How can I see great acting?
Right.
And how can I see celebrities? This was a who's who in this audience.
Right.
And a personal note, in the audience was
Billy Gardell.
Okay. And he was super nice.
Yeah.
Teresa Ganzel was in the audience, and this is an actress now in her late 50s who does much voice work. Her voice is immediately recognizable. She's in every Pixar movie.
Right.
But when I was 13 years old,
here we go.
I had such an enormous crush on this woman from movies like My Favorite Year and the Richard Pryor movie, The Toy.
Oh, my God.
She was this beautiful, blonde bombshell who was so hysterically funny.
Right.
The combination of, you know, really funny, hot blonde. And so at 13, I had this huge crush on her, and she's in the audience. And it's many years later. It's 30 years later. She's more beautiful now than she was then. I mean, the crush is very much still intact.
Oh, no. Did you go?
I didn't. She made a beeline. I think she sensed
the weirdness,
the stalkerness of the moment, and she made a beeline out of it.
Rightly so.
Anyway.
If I see her, I will warn her to stay away.
Well, that's your live event of the week. So what have you been reading, Dean Hagland?
I'm still on the American to Paris, and then I just picked up a book of art criticism by a feller who I've promptly forgot. But he's been an art critic for major magazines and newspapers, and all of his art criticisms are put together. Because as an artist, it's actually good to read about art criticism at the same time. You know, well, we could talk about celebrity deaths later.
Celebrity deaths.
Sure.
But, you know, Neiman Leroy, that artist who'd...
Leroy Neiman.
Yes, that guy. Who had
he was not actually Japanese.
He was not. Yeah. But he had no, he had very few critics applauding his work.
Right.
Even though he was a multi-million dollar artist. But
my favorite joke ever about any artist is in the Zucker, Abram Zucker movie, Top Secret, when the East German commandant trying to torture information out of someone says, bring in the Leroy Neiman paintings. And he's cautioned that they don't want to violate the Geneva Convention.
Yeah. See, that kind of critical analysis. So I'm reading a book that is of an art critic, and I'm reminded of the artist who passed.
Well, that just led us into, I guess, celebrity deaths.
Why not?
And then I'll get to what I'm reading.
Okay.
So here's
celebrity deaths.
Your other celebrity death. Nora Ephron.
Oh, yeah.
She died at 71. She was an essayist, of course, a novelist, and a filmmaker. Yeah. And really, you got to think maybe the only, one of the only real power female filmmakers in the studio
right.
system. In big-time Hollywood movie making, one of the really the only power women. I think Streisand, obviously. But her power comes from her stardom. And this is someone whose power came from being a writer.
Being a writer, of all things. And writing Sleepless in Seattle. And
3-time Academy Award nominee for writing When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
And for co-writing Sleepless in Seattle and Silkwood.
Oh, I didn't know.
She directed 8 films, including Sleepless in Seattle, Michael, You've Got Mail, and fairly recently, Julie and Julia, which was a huge hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What was the dinner one? There was a Coming Home for Thanksgiving one that she directed.
I don't know.
I can't remember.
So, married 3 times.
Wow.
To novelist Dan Greenberg, of course, to journalist Carl Bernstein.
Yes, that was a big deal.
Of Woodward and Bernstein. And survived by her husband, Nicholas Pileggi, the author of Goodfellas.
Of Goodfellas, yeah.
So,
lots of literary fascinating dinner conversation around the table there, I'm sure.
Now, certainly not a power female filmmaker, though a powerful creative filmmaker, certainly in that sense. Miranda July, I'm still reading her book, It Chooses You.
Right.
And this might be a book you want to read. You might really enjoy this. I keep saying that she's...
My doppelganger.
Not doppelganger. I think there's some... quite frankly, we should, I don't know, do some project with the two of you together. I don't know. But it's fantastic. And these transcripts of her interviews with these people she meets through the Penny Saver while paralleling what's going on through the development of her movie, The Future, is really a fantastic, revealing look into her process.
Wow.
And like I've always said, her process is really very interesting. It is fascinating. And I'm still reading the never-ending tome, the epic about Boris Karloff.
Yes.
More Than a Monster.
How far are you up in his life now? He's now in Broadway touring.
Late 1940s.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to say one of the real fun things being in the film business and reading about the history is that little things like this will sneak up on you. I was reading about, I talked about the staging of Arsenic and Old Lace, the production of it.
Right.
Well, during the tail end of the war, a touring production of World War II, a touring production was set up to go entertain the troops in the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
And he was asked to help advise, and he said, no, I want to go do it.
Oh.
So here's this man who's in his 50s. He's had his spinal cord fused.
Oh, my gosh.
And he has to go through basic training because he's going into combat zones to perform. And often some of the actors in the show would be men in those platoons that had been trained specifically for the production and additionally a cast. The only other professional actor was Sergeant George Schaefer, who also directed these productions and drove the bus from base to base.
Are you getting through the Pacific?
And there's these stories about Sergeant George Schaefer and it was so cool to read because Sergeant George Schaefer, in addition to becoming a very important director of Broadway and film, but especially Broadway and television, would also be a thesis advisor for one young Phil Larenas.
Look at that. And you had no idea he was driving the bus in World War II for Mr. Boris Karloff and Arsenic and L.A.
Yeah, and to read these and to see these young photos of him in these fatigues and everything, it was really cool.
That is so cool.
It was very, very cool.
That is awesome.
We did have, I don't know how much time we have left. I think we're almost done. But
that's our show.
We have half a question to keep answering from last week from LeJean Johnson, and then a question from Ulrika to get to. And the question that we left hanging from LeJean was this issue about rituals, because we talked about our rituals in going to see films.
Right.
But he was wondering, in terms of our work with The Truth Is Out There, which people can find at truth-is-out-there.com.
Rolls off the tongue.
What role do rituals play in conspiracy theories and with theorists? And I was actually thinking about this, and I was thinking that a great place to start is the work of Dan Brown, these books, Lost Symbol.
Lost Symbol, right? Angels and Demons.
The distrust that surrounds so many rituals and what hidden meanings might be being ingrained and expressed through this ritual. We live in a very interesting time because I think there is an incredible hunger for ritual. A lot of sociological studies have been done about that being the real attraction towards gangs for youth, is as we've stripped away more and more ritual from children.
Yeah.
They seek it. And remember that quote that I read last week about young souls seek out rituals, but also just in the sense that youth seek out rituals.
Yeah.
And
this is the thing that's happening in Hollywood too, is this, a lot of the young hip kids are joining the Masons, the Freemasons, because there is ingrained in there a 2,000 to 5,000 year old ritualistic, and symbolic. I mean, it's now symbolic, but it's a ritual of the building of Solomon's Temple. Like, all of these things are referred to over and over again. And in a city where you are technically baseless and you've often moved from somewhere else, so to find community and ritual, that you joining the Freemasons in all of its conspiracy is a way that now a lot of the young guys and girls have the female equivalent to Freemasons as well.
So for many researchers into conspiracy, it is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
There is this fear of the rituals, of these hidden rituals, and even the open rituals
and the open rituals
of what's being expressed, religious rituals, and all these sort of things.
And Jordan Maxwell is big on that, on terms of, you know, what we do in the court of law and why they wear the black robe and all of these things, and how that traces back through history to these not even pagan but pre pseudo. And I don't even want to say religiosic rituals, but that these things are then taken into our society in terms of legal matters, in terms of justice, in terms of voting and that kind of thing.
Right. And the challenge is always to breathe life into any institution, and therefore the rituals that are part of that institution, breathing life into it rather than it becoming rote, rather than it becoming mindless. What does it mean? What does it make you feel? What are you embodying when you do this?
Right.
Then it becomes instructive. And I mean, I'm always struck about the rituals just of getting married and how much we, you know, we just take for granted. We don't even understand the rites and where these things come from. One of my favorite, and this is a story that I always like to share, you know, the ritual of carrying the bride across the threshold.
Oh, yes.
Into the bedchamber, and where this originated. It originated because they knew, the people that started this ritual, this particular ritual, they knew that the devil cannot enter the dwelling under his own power.
Ah.
Think of like vampires. They can't be allowed in unless invited in. They knew this. Right. Somehow they knew this. We invite the devil in through network television.
Yes.
I don't know. Don't turn 24-hour news.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Somehow.
But Anderson Cooper, I'm talking to you. So, but think of this. So then the ritual is you carry your bride across the threshold. And think about the heresy and of witches, the punishment, the rooting out of evil that always took on female form. Right?
Of course.
So the ritual is a powerful one. When you pick up your bride to carry her across the threshold, the statement you are making is, I have faith that you are not the devil. It's an act of faith to show your bride how much faith you have in her, rather than expecting her to prove she's not the devil by walking in under her own power.
I see. Though, you know, I'm sure many a divorce would not have happened if they just said, could you walk in on your own power, please?
Wow.
And if they didn't.
Are you going back to Katie and Tom?
I don't know who's Satan in that relationship, but clearly.
Why does anyone have to be Satan in a relationship?
It doesn't have to be. I'm sure there's many happy satanic relationships out
there. So this is very interesting, this
idea of ritual.
Yeah.
And that it's actually really important in conspiracy, because if a lot of the rituals that, where the meaning's been lost, and you go back to find A, what was the original meaning, and B, why was that meaning removed or played down over the generations?
And at the same time, though, don't get bogged down in that.
Right.
Because the rituals evolve, and they can, and there is something universal about them, just because that might have been the political intent
at the time.
It also might have spoken to some part of ourselves that goes well beyond the political.
Absolutely.
And we can, if we can redeem it, if we can revive it, if we can breathe life into it so that it has meaning to us, we can liberate ourselves from any ideas, again, of mindless rote repetition, but also free ourselves from the fear of what original intent might be. Oh, when you're doing this, don't you understand what it means?
Right.
No, you know what? You get to dictate what it means.
Because
what it
ritual,
means to you.
Yes, you get to redefine that.
What it means to you is what it means, because that's how you are embodying it, and that's what you are creating.
Right.
We might actually talk a little bit more about this at the end when we get to liberation. Just became the word again.
Oh, look at that.
Well.
Because
celebrating
it's Independence Day.
Question from Ulrika.
Yes.
Was about the difference between U.S. and U.K., but I also think European, probably, a film and TV production.
Oh, right.
And boy, this is a small topic, isn't it?
It is.
Would start with this. This will be my first. And there was a New York Times article. I don't know if you saw this.
No,
week,
I missed it.
How does the film industry actually make money? Which is basically what we've been talking about nonstop for the last couple of years. How do they?
Exactly. You
know, they're really in a lot of trouble because of all these old distribution models that have been propping up these gigantic corporations.
Right.
And they can no longer afford that kind of overhead. They're not flexible enough. Either creatively or financially, again, institution. The institution needs to change.
To collapse and redo.
But that is the big difference between, I think, the U.S. and entertainment, probably anywhere else in the world, is it is a it is predominantly here an industry run by conglomerates.
Now.
By giant corporations.
Right.
And that isn't true anywhere else. And one of the things that shows you that is when you see a film from Europe, one of those handful of films that actually gets distributed here.
Yes, rarely.
You see 15 companies listed at the beginning.
Yeah.
The funding came from this pastiche of dozens of companies at a fraction of the cost of a studio film.
Right.
And of course here, the studio films might have two or three names listed.
Right.
In terms of where the funding came from.
Right. That's the production company and the studio and then the licensing.
And maybe one foreign partner.
Yeah.
But the cobbling together of financing internationally. And whereas the problem with that could be too many cooks in the kitchen.
Right.
In reality, what seems to be is it almost gives the storytellers in film and television more freedom.
More freedom, because you don't have to cotton to
any particular one.
Absolutely.
They're all on board with the idea, and now we're giving the filmmakers, the showrunner, if it's television, we're giving them their freedom to do what we signed on for.
Right. And there was also a time where the studios were like part of a hedge fund almost, where banks would invest in the studio, and then the studio would take that money and go off and make films, so that you actually had multiple partners, but it was filtered through the studio, like Paramount, And that was that famous Deutsche Bank deal that fell apart because they were getting $220 million a year from Deutsche Bank, and Paramount was just putting it into the lower tier movies and using their own money for their top five blockbuster hits, and then telling Deutsche Bank, yeah, it's another year we didn't make any money. And Deutsche Bank got wise to that and pulled out that $220 million.
And of course, fewer and fewer films are actually being made by the studios nowadays. And even in television, you know, the economics are really changing.
Yeah.
Right? How can... No show has ever made money in its first run. And now you have quote-unquote hit shows on cable, like Breaking Bad, for example, and Mad Men. And the networks that made them hits can't afford them anymore.
Right. Because they're not
because
making
the cost of making them goes up.
So they demand more from the cable.
That
cable.
Don't have the money.
And so Dish Network has to drop AMC. And then AMC then goes, hey, complain to Dish Network that we're being dropped because now you won't see Breaking Bad and
But
and
one
Mad
of the
Men.
Things that you are seeing is with these shows, with these quality shows, not only on the basic cable, but also on the home box office, you have limited series, which is really borrowing a model from
the 70s.
The UK.
Oh, the UK, that's right. Where they
right,
would
these
just
shorter series.
Six episodes was considered a season.
And you'll find that on, and they're like with Breaking Bad. Okay, well, why don't we do two short seasons then instead of one long season?
Right. They're going to do five episodes and five episodes or something like that.
And so we're starting to see more in television starting to reflect what it is like in the UK. And again, not surprisingly, the overall quality seems to go up in those environments because
right.
you don't have to bang out 22 shows.
And get towards the end of the season where the train is off the rails and you're overwhelmed like it was on The X-Files. By the time we got to like episode 18, we were shooting six or seven episodes simultaneously, trying to finish up old ones, ones that were, you know...
People burn
scenes
out.
And people burn out. And
not only
like
during the season, but in the long run.
Yeah.
People burn out and people want to leave. Would David Duchovny have wanted to leave the show so desperately if he had the time to go do other projects instead of shoehorning something into the
summer hiatus?
The summer hiatus.
Right.
When he really probably would have been better off just recharging his batteries.
Right.
But the actor in you wants to go do something different.
Right.
And if you had time to do that... like you do in the UK.
Yes.
Then when you come to television, the work you're doing is even better.
So much better.
Because you are coming back to it fresh. You are recharged.
And when you think about the X-Files is an excellent example. Had that show been in a UK model where they only did like six episodes per season, or maybe eight, and you think back now to the really quality X-File episodes, there were really only six or eight per season. And the others were, you know, either monsters of the week or, you know, stuff that there was tossed out by other writers, not the big four. You then realize that the UK model actually is how the artists work in television, and that this 22 episode is a dictation from the advertisers and the studio going, listen, we want 22 episodes starting in September. Why September? Because that's when the new cars came out, and we want to have new shows to go with the commercials for the new cars in the 1950s. And that's why September was traditionally our start of our new television season. No other reason. It was the car manufacturers dictating the advertising, dictating to the artists and everybody when the new season starts.
And now it's much more of a, you know, it's 12 months a year. It's 24 hours. The promotional cycle of, oh, did you hear? You know, Breaking Bad's going to premiere on July 15th. You know,
right.
The dates are always
all over the place.
And it kind of creates more excitement
that
way. You're not getting excited about one date each year. You're getting excited about your show coming back.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so it does create a smaller audience, but it also does create more of a relationship, I think, with the audience in that particular show.
Absolutely. And the way we consume it, I mean, with TiVo and everything, is that we are just naming the show and then the computer finds it. So,
and in film, I think, again, more and more of the U.S. production is starting to borrow pages from Europe and the U.K.
Mm-hmm.
Because more and more of our films are independent.
Mm-hmm.
And more and more of our independent films are things where you say, wow, that's like a European film, only without the bad subtitles, without boring subtitles. They're not speaking a weird language.
Right.
And you'll see that again, the 15 companies that put together the financing on things.
Right.
And this is making up more and more of the product that actually gets made. I saw a couple of films this week by probably two of the really the most important names we can be discussing, I think, going forward when we're talking about independent films. One is from the Duplass brothers, and Mark Duplass. I've been seeing Mark Duplass in acting in a whole bunch of films.
Yeah, this guy's a powerhouse.
But I saw Jeff Who Lives at Home.
Yeah, what'd you think?
With Ed Helms and... Jason Segel.
Segel, yeah.
And Susan Sarandon. This is a film that's set, that takes place in one day. And the script, you know that the actors read this and go, oh, this is great. And then when that one day comes to life in the film, it's not satisfying.
Ouch.
It's not a bad film. It's just, you know, it's good people doing good work and trying a worthwhile concept that just never quite comes together.
Do you have a directorial solution for this one?
Like, well, that's what I'm saying. The time lock of it, the time nature of it just didn't work cinematically.
I see.
I think it worked in reading it. From a writing standpoint, it worked. From a visual standpoint, it did not work.
Mm.
I like that I got a sense of the place of where they were. You know, as I like when locales are a real character in
a
format. The other side to this, though, and someone who makes locales absolutely a character and who I think at this point can't do anything wrong is Jeff Nichols.
Uh-huh.
And this is the director who made the film that was very high on my top 10 list last year, Take Shelter.
Oh, yes.
With Michael Shannon and Jessica Chastain. Michael Shannon gave maybe the best performance of any actor last year, and the film was, you know, received awards at Cannes and was extraordinary. Take Shelter, extraordinarily tough to watch until an ending
that
makes you so overjoyed that you saw the film. Shotgun Stories is their earlier collaboration, Jeff Nichols and Michael Shannon,
right?
Again, and it's about two sets of brothers by the same father.
Ah.
And the feud that erupts between them after that man dies.
Ah.
And how he lived his life and what got visited upon these different sets of brothers by the way he first lived his life and then decided to absolve or disclaim that life altogether and start over as a good man. And what comes down between them. And it is a wonderfully tense and, again, challenging film and so truthful. And these performances are wonderful. And also what's great about him is he will have these films that are rife with conflict, rife with violence, and yet never approaches them from an exploitive position. Always from a questioning and probing kind of standpoint. Mm. What can we learn from these circumstances? And it's great. And he is a storyteller that gets it. He gets how questions that go unresolved within people will then be visited upon their offspring and how those issues, and especially
fantastic,
the inherited nature of mental illness is something he's really fascinated by. So Jeff Nichols may be, to me, the most important filmmaker working in independent film, American independent film.
Wow.
And his relationship with Michael Shannon, both, you know, as a filmmaker and as a director working with an actor, the comparison I would draw is early 70s Scorsese and Robert De Niro.
Wow.
I am watching the Scorsese that was doing Mean Streets, the Scorsese that was doing Taxi Driver. That's who I'm seeing with Jeff Nichols. He has a film, I think, called Mud, or maybe Mud something. I don't remember the full name, but it stars Matthew McConaughey.
Uh-huh.
It just played at Cannes. It'll be coming out later this year. Michael Shannon's in it again. And, oh, by the way, to draw that, just to put a period on that comparison, how about the fact that Michael Shannon achieves a certain level of fame now, finally, after being so good for so long, by being the star of Martin Scorsese's Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, right? How about that?
So someone else may have seen that comparison.
Yeah, not the only one. Fantastic.
We start talking about independent film, and there we are. Here it is, Independence Day.
Full of fireworks.
How much time do we have left, Dean
Haglund?
We
have a whole 15 minutes, maybe a little less. But
well, you know, 10. I rewatched...
What'd you watch?
Episode 1 of Aaron Sorkin's Newsroom.
Oh, you did?
I rewatched it because...
You didn't give this big kudos last week.
No, I said that it had real possibility. I did not watch episode 2 last night, so I don't know. But I wanted to go. I wanted to watch episode 1 again for two reasons. One, because I wanted to, having now seen it and having now known what my dissatisfaction was, I wanted to let go of, okay, this is Aaron Sorkin. I wanted to let go of having seen so many previews of it for so long.
Holy smokes.
And I wanted to just watch it again and really assess, okay, what is working?
Yes.
What is, and lead with what was good about it.
Very good.
And I really enjoyed my second viewing of it more.
Really?
I think Emily Mortimer is miscast. She's a wonderful actress. I think she's miscast.
Yeah.
I don't believe her as the executive producer who's been embedded in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and been under fire for all these years. I don't buy it.
She doesn't have the grit.
And so I see an actress delivering speeches.
Yes. Bit sad.
And then that's when you start to hear the Aaron Sorkin speeches.
Right.
Whereas Jeff Daniels has a way, even with these speeches, of just
embodying
making
them.
You really feel you're seeing the character reveal himself when he doesn't want to be revealing himself.
Right.
And in ways he doesn't want to be, which is very exciting. But I thought also it was kind of fun to watch it again, apropos of this being Independence Day and America celebrating itself.
Right.
Which I think we do a lot of.
We do, yeah, there's a lot of that going on.
And at the same time, maybe we do need it more than ever if what I read is true and that this is the most divisive time since the Civil War. Maybe we do need to hopefully remind ourselves of what it means to be American and what we're celebrating and ask that. You know, what do we mean by independence? And I just was struck by the speech that Jeff Daniels gives at the beginning of Newsroom where he lists the fact that, you know, we celebrate every, well, in light of the fact that we're about to celebrate how it's freedom that makes America great. And in this speech in Newsroom, you know, Jeff Daniels' character, Will McAvoy, points out that there's 207 sovereign nations in the world.
Yeah.
And 180 of them have freedom. It's not what it once was, which
right.
is this rarity in the world. And of those 207 sovereign nations, we are 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy,
mm-hmm.
178th in infant mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Out of 207.
That's, yeah.
Third in median household income. Which makes you think, if we're third in median income and we're 178th in infant, how is that happening?
Thank God we're not Uruguay.
Number four in labor force, number four in exports. We lead the world in three categories.
Right.
Number of incarcerated citizens per capita.
Yeah.
Number of adults who believe angels are real.
Yes.
And, of course, defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are our allies.
Right.
And so in this speech, he talks about what really did make America great, which was this, that we were a nation, you know, according to the words of Aaron Sorkin, that stood up for what was right, that fought for moral reasons, and that passed and struck down laws for moral reasons. And I would say that, you know, what I am proud of in having been born an American and being an American and having read about my history
mm-hmm.
is that it has been a history perhaps inspired by very dark chapters in that history.
Right.
But it is a history of a people constantly being inspired to make corrections and try to do things better.
Right. To see the faults and rework it.
And I don't know of any other country that has quite that history of, you know, this Constitution, since being passed, has allowed the flexibility for so many course corrections and for so much to be built, not
right.
only from military and science and technology, but also an economy, and an economy that's much younger than the country itself.
Yeah.
And inevitably, these things are so successful, they become quite powerful. And as we've talked about on this show so many times before, those things within us and those things that we create that are strong will also ultimately become a weakness.
Absolutely.
And so that constant ability to navigate changes and say, okay, we need to fix this. We need to correct this. We can't become so beholden to, well, this that's the idea. Way that it works.
Yes.
That we don't fix it.
Right.
And our history has for a long time been that we've been willing to, even if we're willing to do it only kicking and screaming.
Right.
Even if it's only after really, really dark chapters.
Bloodshed.
It is. And so the question becomes, will we do it again? Do we have another chapter in us to write that looks at all the things that are standing in the way of forming a more perfect union?
Right.
And again, there's that word, a more perfect union.
Right.
It's not about my country. It's not about taking back America from
someone
else. It's about how can we have union.
Union with the people who are here now. Here, you know, this is the whole other thing of the anti-immigration bias is that it's a nation of immigrants. And having been a guy who came here from another country, it is also that you form your new group with what you got.
And, you know, sometimes I think these times of crisis occur because we do somehow in us, we know that freedom is not a destination.
Right.
Freedom is it's something for which you strive.
Right.
You never achieve it. It's constantly
evolving.
It needs to be
nurtured,
strived for again and again and again. Every new challenge, and again, everything that's successful, then can threaten that.
Right.
Because nothing traps you like success.
It's true.
It's why failure so often leads to those successes, because failure is liberating. Success becomes very inculcating, because you go, oh, that worked, so we have to repeat it.
Yes. Do that thing that worked again.
Yeah.
And then that's why sequels tend to suck.
And that's why we look to independent films, because we look for independent ideas, for new ideas that we're not seeing somewhere else.
Yes, in the studio system.
Independence. And so always the question is, when we're celebrating freedom, when we're celebrating independence, I think the question has to be now, to breathe life back into it, independence from what?
Right.
What are we seeking independence to? And I think we are at this time now where it truly is independence from ideas that enslave us.
Right. What are the ideas that are entrenched?
I often see this fighting mentality of, whether it be some conspiracy theorists that we've met,
yes,
you know, about these people are doing this to take away our freedom, or liberals saying we need to fight the terrifying prospect of the right-wing super PACs taking over, or
the right
Christian
wing.
Conservatives saying we need to take it back from the liberal conspiracy, and you know, all of this, and they've all found villains that are threatening our freedom.
Right.
Okay. I am a voice that says I think independence comes from liberating ourselves from ideas that are enslaving us. If you recognize that what you choose to believe is going to be your truth, and that is, there's this line in the Aaron Sorkin thing in Newsroom, that it's not only that we live at a time now where people get to choose what news they read. You and I have talked about that.
Yes.
You get to choose what facts
you want to find
are going to be your facts.
Yeah.
You can find entirely different sets of facts. Know that when you choose a set of facts, you are creating the world that you live in. Now, those facts might have come to you, so you're only co-creating them. But that's why it becomes all the more important to open your arms as wide as you possibly can, open your mind as much as you can, say yes to all the facts that people are sharing with you, so that you yourself have the ability to build as beautiful a world for yourself as you possibly can. And when you do that, you give permission to other people to do the same thing.
Right.
So on Independence Day, if America has it in itself to lead the world again as a beacon of liberty, I think moving forward in this 21st century, it's to shine the light into the darkness of our own fears that enslave us, and liberate ourselves from those ideas, and find out how those ideas serve us and how they can inspire us to do better, to live big, to be of service. Nothing frees you like being of service. It's such an interesting trap that we think, oh, I don't have time to be of service because I've got so much to do, so much on my plate. I've got so much. But when then suddenly you find the time when it is inconvenient, because we are not measured by what we do when it's convenient. We are measured by what we do when it isn't convenient. But when we are of service, we suddenly realize how much bigger the world gets.
Yes.
So
let us remember that.
Live big and live free in that way. And that's how I'm going, what I'm going to be ruminating on this Independence Day.
Look at that. Fantastic. Wow, that was awesome. And of course, you can find every episode, almost every episode.
One day you'll be able to find all episodes of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. In fact, the next two from the archive we're going to be putting up are the two episodes that Vince Gilligan did. And we're going to get those up in time for the new season premiere of Breaking Bad. So look for those. Yes. Chillpackhollywood.com, Chillpack Hollywood.com. Mm-hmm.
Find us on Facebook. We talked about that. You can see us, you can email us,
chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
We're still on MySpace, apparently.
MySpace.com/chillpackhollywood.
I haven't been there in a while. Twitter, follow me at D Haglin.
And I'm at Phil Lernis.
And thanks
and,
to Jack.
Check out our Kickstarter.
Oh, our Kickstarter. We got a great Kickstarter.
For Hieroglyph of the Human Soul. And this is a project that's going to be a lot about this, about ideas that liberate.
Yes.
How do we foster and nourish and encourage ideas that liberate? And how do we find it in ourselves to realize that we're going to lose our way, and that it's that real freedom comes from the greater our ability to navigate the way things change,
right?
And to be okay with changes and sudden changes. How better do we become navigators of those changes? Because that's what will lead us to greater freedom. So check that out on Kickstarter, and please give generously.
Yes,
Kickstarter.
Lots of great
Hieroglyph
rewards.
Of the Human Soul, or if you just plug in Phil Lernis, you'll find it. And of course, we'll have the link on our site as well.
Till next week, I'm Dean Haglin.
I'm Phil Lernis.
See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.